This is In the Hive, a show that looks at the issues and ideas that tie the Greater Salt Lake Valley together. I'm Emily Means, and today on the show, we're looking at the local response to last Saturday's events in Charlottesville, Virginia. On August 12th, hundreds of white nationalists, Ku Klux Klan members, neo-Nazis, and other racist groups marched with torches and guns at the Unite the Right rally to protest the removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. The groups were met by counter-protesters, and violence broke out, resulting in the death of Heather Heyer, who was killed when a man associated with the white nationalist groups drove a car through a crowd of people. Utahns' response to the demonstration and attack in Charlottesville was quick, and on Monday, two rallies were organized in Salt Lake City. Later in the program, we'll revisit the Solidarity Rally hosted by the Utah League of Native American Voters, as well as feature a conversation about the roots of nationalism and hate groups in America with Edmund Fong, professor of ethnic studies and political science at the University of Utah. But first, a look at the event hosted by the Utah Republican Party up at the state capitol. 100 or so people attended the GOP-led rally, billed as One Utah, Rally for Unity, early Monday evening. I asked participants why the events in Charlottesville compelled them to show up.
I am Chris Harrelson from Orem, Utah. The United States is a pluralistic nation. We are a melting pot of immigrants from all over the world, and that is a founding principle that makes our country so diverse and so beautiful, and we have to defend that. And anything that challenges that needs to be challenged in return, so that's why I'm here.
Justin Anderson, and I'm from Orem, Utah. All politics is local, but this isn't politics, this is humanity, and I have to take a stand for what is right.
The rally featured speeches by Utah politicos, including Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox and Salt Lake City Democratic Representative Sandra Hollins, who encouraged attendees to work together to do better. Congresswoman Mia Love also spoke. Here's an excerpt from her speech that evening.
You know, when I was growing up, the first job I had was actually teaching swim classes to some kindergartners and first graders. And it would be a 6-week period where we would teach these swim classes. And my goal was to do everything I could to make sure that by the time these kids left me, they knew how to swim. I mean, I was just determined in that quest. And at the end of one 6-week period, a young boy put his arm around me and he said, "I want you to know that I like you, even though my mom and dad don't." And it was interesting to me, and it was so profound because I kept thinking in my head, I wonder what prompted that statement. I've never had an interaction with his parents. I didn't know why he would say that. So I prodded a little bit and I said, "Well, why wouldn't your mom and dad like me?" And he said, "Because you're black and they think all black people are bad." I learned 3 things that day. One is we cannot go around being victims. We are empowered. We need to be comfortable in our skin, where we stand, and in our presence. Amen. 2, hatred is taught. Hatred is taught. Somebody put it in that child's head that they should not like someone because of the color of their skin. It is taught. Which means that we have to be an example. And last but not least, where it is taught, by being an example, it can be reversed. It absolutely can be reversed. For that kid to leave and say, "I like you, even though my mom and dad don't," I felt like that was an accomplishment. That was American and America at its best.
That was Congresswoman Mia Love, a Republican representing Utah's 4th Congressional District at the Rally for Unity. An hour and a half later, at the Salt Lake City and County Building, about 1,000 people crowded around a stage at the Utah League of Native American Voters-hosted Solidarity Rally, focusing on anti-racism, people of color, and allies. I asked attendees the same question. Why did you come out tonight?
I'm Pamela from Las Vegas. I'm here to hopefully be shown that others not like me, not just people of color, care. I think our words don't always capture the emotion of feeling connected to others, and that's where I'm at. There's not enough. I don't have the full words to express the solidarity that I do feel, and I want to see it go beyond this event. I want to see people do more than just come to a rally. I want dialogue in your home, in your workplace. This isn't new, and it's subtle, and it's in other spaces.
My name is Sani Itzidi, and I'm from Cove, Arizona. So I'm here to promote unity. I have a sign here that says, I'm actually Mormon, and so it's from the Doctrine and Covenants, which is a holy scripture. It's from Doctrine and Covenants 38:27, and it says, "Behold, I say unto you, be one. And if ye are not one, ye are not mine." And so that's the Lord speaking. And he's just saying that we are all of his children, and that if we're not unified, then we're not really his.
Representatives from Utah's faith communities and advocacy groups, as well as elected officials, talked about actively standing up against hate. Ian De Oliveira of Utahns Against Police Brutality was one of the featured speakers.
So I want to talk for a moment about cause and effect. What inspires these sentiments? What inspires white supremacy, Nazis, and fascists to spring up around us and among us? But we must examine the rhetoric. What do they say about us? They are right over there, at least they were. They ran away, but they were. What do they say about us? They say that we are lazy. They say that we do not have jobs, that we are criminals, that we are thugs. They say that we carry disease. They say we are drug addicts. They say we are without morals. This is the rhetoric that they use, and it is not new. It is not new. This is the same rhetoric that has been carried through the ages to justify some of the worst atrocities that have befallen anyone on this planet. I get it, I really do. We have known nothing but struggle all our lives, but this is why we are going to win, because those who dare to struggle dare to win, and we have known nothing but struggle, so we will know nothing but victory.
That was Ian De Oliveira of Utahns Against Police Brutality at the Solidarity Rally Monday night. The rallies in Salt Lake were two among hundreds that took place around the nation following last weekend's events, events that have put a renewed focus on the white supremacist movement in America today and the tactics used by that movement to spread its controversial message. To learn more, I spoke with Dr. Edmund Fong, professor of ethnic studies and political science at the University of Utah, who's written about race, racism, and racial politics in America's history and present. In the context of the self-identification by some of the attendees of the Charlottesville rally as white nationalists, I asked Dr. Fong about the definitions of the terms patriotism and nationalism. I think when a lot of people envision patriotism, you know, we think of American flags waving in the background or standing for the national anthem, these sorts of things. But patriotism isn't necessarily interchangeable with nationalism, is it?
It depends on who you talk to about what it means to be who can be a patriot. And this gets back to the question of what is added to nationalism when you add whiteness to it, or when you modify it by being a white nationalist, right? I mean, the American nation has always involved non-whites from the very beginning. You know, 1/5 of the population at the time of the founding were people of African descent. So it's never strictly been a white nation, right? And obviously, increasingly since the 1960s, the country has become more multicultural diverse, right? And so that is one of the major kind of sort of fuels for these white nationalist movements, right? And so you could be a nationalist in a way that encompasses everyone of whatever racial background. But, you know, when you are identified as a white nationalist, that then there's something going on there about what it means to be white that is central to what it means to stand up for and be a patriot for the American nation.
Well, let's talk about how racism ties into this. And going back to Charlottesville, the photos and videos we saw were of young white men predominantly. So some of the people who sign on to these hate groups, including, I mean, the groups are involved, the Ku Klux Klan, Vanguard America, these sorts of groups. Why are these younger white men signing on to these hate groups? Is it because they've been marginalized in some way, maybe economically or at a societal level? What is it that's attracting them?
Well, I mean, I don't want to pathologize them, but that is one of the sort of common grievances you hear that animates people who get involved in these organizations, you know. One of the people who went to the rally who was subsequently outed on social media spoke about how he was just there to preserve and protect what he saw as, you know, white European culture, right? And so there's a kind of grievance, a sense that they have been victimized by a larger society or a larger government in America that, you know, doesn't care for their interests or doesn't care for their economic well-being. So many of them do tend to be kind of on the more economically marginalized, you know, side of things. If you go back to the Charleston massacre in 2015, you know, Dylann Roof, you know, was also someone who was not, we would say, very well socially adjusted. And the same is true of the alleged driver who is alleged to have killed Heather Heyer, James Alex Fields, right? So, yeah, they tend to be young white males drifting from job to job oftentimes who, you know, are find themselves gravitating towards some kind of ideology or narrative or community that can sort of make them feel better about themselves, right? That they have the power to take things back in their control.
I'm glad, actually, that you brought up that young man from Reno who was part of this rally. He's a university student, and I actually have that quote that I thought was interesting. He says, "I came to this march for the message that white European culture has a right to be here just like every culture. It's not perfect. There are flaws to it, of course. However, I do believe that the replacement of the statue," and that's of Confederate leader Robert E. Lee, "will be the slow replacement of white heritage within the United States and the people who fought and defended and built their homeland." So I'm really curious about this this idea that white history is somehow being erased, because in America's retelling of history, white people are, of course, at the center of that story. So what is it about, you know, these remnants of history that, you know, they're being taken down, these statues being taken down? Why is that threatening to these groups?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting puzzle. Obviously, a claim like that, however genuinely believed, and this University of Reno felt, he sounded like he was genuinely shocked that, you know, that he was being portrayed as the face of evil, you know, in attending this rally. It's kind of, it's preposterous on its face, the idea that this country is now at a point where whites are an endangered minority, right? I mean, if you have any sort of basic understanding of American history, I mean, even to this day, you know, you look at people who occupy positions of power, it's overwhelmingly white, right? Or people in positions of influence. But yet, this, that sort of narrative is very persuasive for a number of reasons, I think, for people like, you know, young white males or young whites in general, who are themselves, you know, more down and out, perhaps. Is because, on the one hand, the country has become more multicultural in the last few decades since the civil rights era. We've liberalized our immigration laws, and so most of the immigrants that come here are from non-European countries. So the complexion of America has changed, and that really visibly came to bear in, you know, in the 1990s when you had that Time magazine article. I don't know if you remember, the cover said "The Browning of America" or "The New America," and then it showed, you know, basically all, you know, sort of a motley collection of brown-hued people. Right. And so when, if you don't really know kind of a better understanding of history, and you see that, and you see just people on the street, there are more, you know, people of color, and that people of color are in more sort of dynamic positions, and you yourself are in a kind of economically marginalized position, you might feel like, well, yeah, the reality of my experience is that it seems like I'm losing out here, right? I'm being left behind here, right? That my culture is sort of not being preserved or honored. And then when you have these movements to, you know, remove and replace Confederate symbols and monuments, then that becomes a flashpoint for that. And the sort of visible symbol, yeah, to them, you know, someone is making these decisions to, you know, put them in a box somewhere or something like that.
Right. I think there's actually census data or some census estimates that in 2040, I'll have to check up on this, but white people in America will actually become a minority group.
Yeah.
Why do you think some white people are scared of becoming a minority?
Mm-hmm. Well, because for most of American history, you know, sort of white supremacist ideologies were dominant in this country's history. And so whenever you had sort of economic dislocations, like say in the 19th century or the turn of the 20th century, oftentimes the way for Americans, white Americans in particular, to express those concerns was to hold on to a notion of whiteness that could, you know, kind of solve all problems or restore a proper balance to things while also blaming, you know, other groups, you know, the marginalized groups, people of color, for the ills confronting the country at that time, right? And so it was the Irish in the mid-19th century who were coming in at large numbers at that time who were blamed for, you know, sort of the changing economics of the mid-19th century. And then later towards the late 19th century, you had Chinese immigrants being blamed, and then other sort of Southern and Eastern Europeans around the turn of the 20th century. Right? So whiteness is often a means to, you know, kind of understand that there is some original pure kind of foundation to the country that when things go bad, we can turn back to, right, and restore things. Right? And so that seems to be very much in play today.
I want to talk a bit about how ingrained, really, racism is in our country's history. Yeah. The comparison between institutionalized racism and, you know, instances of hate crimes or like what we saw in Charlottesville this past weekend. Because in America, we have open racism of, say, white supremacists, but we also do have systemic racism that shows up in things like incarceration rates or housing policy. When we have a surge in these more overt instances of racism, do we also see a surge in systemic racism? Do they enable each other? Is there any data on this?
Yeah, there's definitely a symbiosis between the two. I mean, but there are also two distinct sides. And I'll give you an example. You know, I'm teaching a class right now on American race, or I will be starting next week, on American racism. And the focus of that class is on lynching in America, which sort of dominated the country roughly for a 70-year period from, you know, roughly the 1880s and 1890s into the 1940s and 1950s. And so lynching, where, you know, thousands of African Americans were seized by mobs and killed, right, and hung, and often mutilated in the process, were, you know, displays of what you might say, you know, organized, quite horrific racist violence, where you had crowds of thousands of Americans, children in the presence of the crowd witnessing the sort of execution of these individuals. So that is, on the one hand, you know, I sort of see it as on the spectrum of, you know, kind of outright racial violence, the racial violence that sort of was on display in Charlottesville. But then on the other hand, during that period, you had the rise of Jim Crow era policy and laws, right, which, you know, designed laws to prevent African Americans from voting, especially in the South, or laws that mandated segregation in rail cars or, you know, theaters or public accommodations. So that is more, as you put it, on the institutionalized racism side. The two proceeded at the same rough period, and they sort of legitimized each other, Right? And so the more you whip up sort of paranoia about African-American males, you know, as a threat to white females and lynch them, the more that fueled and legitimized efforts to institute policies and laws that would maintain African-Americans in a second-class position. And vice versa, you know, if you have these laws that were meant to sort of, you know, police African-Americans officially, but then you also have these, you know, kind of unofficial egregious acts of violence towards them. And so you have that symbiosis. Right now, you know, with police shootings, there's been in recent years much more of a public spotlight on institutionalized racism, especially in police conduct of minority communities and African Americans. And yet you also have this sort of pushback against reform of that through, you know, some of the rise of these kinds of, you know, white supremacist groups and violence on display as a result.
We've reflected back on Jim Crow and lynching. Yeah. Let's look again at the present. You know, people keep saying we're much more divided now than we've ever been. Yeah. But are we living in a more charged time than we've seen in a while? This isn't new, but I don't know. Why is it so jarring to so many people?
Yeah, well, I would say we are living in really highly charged, politically partisan times. In many ways, much more so than I think the 2016 election and the election of Donald Trump really kind of shows that we've reached new levels of partisanship, right? To the point where, you know, this issue of fake news, where even the truth itself is often sort of disputed, right? And where we can't even agree on the size of the crowd at the inauguration of Donald Trump, right? So that is an indication that, yeah, we are in sort of uncharted waters in terms of political partisanship. And that does play a hand in how the sort of animus around race that, you know, that we're seeing with Charlottesville and other events in recent memory. It's not just around the election of Donald Trump in the 2016 election. You know, really the election of Barack Obama as, you know, quote unquote, the first African-American president is something that also kind of set in motion this new animus around race and especially its linkage with political partisanship. Right. One of the interesting things about what I study is that race is often given life through political partisanship. It's not just a unique feature of our time, but it's something that's always been the case. Right? Our political parties have always sort of jockeyed around each other in terms of race and racism. Right? And so the Democratic Party was, you know, in the 19th century, you know, the party that was most identified with white supremacy. And we seem to have switched things around where now the Republican Party is seen as the party that is most associated with, you know, white American support. Right. So partisanship and racism has always had a kind of unique sort of and troubling sort of relationship. And so the increasing partisanship we've been seeing, you know, Trump's rise to political prominence was on the back of the birther movement, right? Delegitimizing and singling out Barack Obama as somehow not a true American. I mean, so that has sort of given fuel, further fuel to that. And his sort of flirtation with, you know, sometimes disavowing, sometimes courting white nationalist groups of various stripes, sometimes having advisors that have direct links to white groups, you know, signals to many of these more fringe groups that we saw in Charlottesville that, well, yeah, they have a new legitimacy, right? That the person in the White House is someone who has their backs to some extent, right? And so that further fuels the sort of validation that people like, you know, James Alex Fields might have, that they're doing, or Richard Spencer, that they're doing something that is not just sort of fringe, that's something that this country had hoped to leave behind, but, you know, now it's their day in the sun, if you will.
Yeah. Edmund, I don't expect you to solve all of America's racial problems right now, but I am wondering if you can maybe give a little bit of advice. I see a lot of talk on social media about shouting down racists and calling them out for what they are. And of course, we should never pretend that racism doesn't exist. But could these more confrontational efforts give fuel to the fire of some of these groups? Is this a productive way to go about things?
So, yeah, I see a lot of sort of hand-wringing and discussion around, say, the free speech rights of, you know, people like Milo Yiannopoulos or Richard Spencer, whether they have the right to espouse their ideological beliefs, you know, on college campuses or what have you. And related to that, as you were saying, whether if we give them more attention or we try to voice criticism of that, that sort of feeds the sense that they are worth talking about. Right? My own view on that is we're beyond that now. With these events, you know, with the 2016 election, where these things were, you know, it used to be that many sort of candidates in recent decades would, you may be familiar with the phrase dog whistle, right?
Sure.
That is to say, candidates would, you know, sort of use language that was not explicitly racially inflammatory, but were coded in a way that to certain audiences, they were a dog whistle to them. That, you know, if you talk about crime, right, in the urban locations, that is a sort of dog whistle for some of the kind of things we saw on that racist flyer that was posted at University of Utah, statistics around black male crime, right? Then so you're in a kind of coded way, you're sort of channeling that. But now we're at the point where people are openly making these kinds of explicitly racist claims. And so the idea that we can simply diminish that by ignoring it, I think we're beyond that. The free speech thing is a little trickier.
It is protected.
It is protected.
Hate
yeah.
speech is also protected.
Yeah. The thing about that, I guess, and again, this is just my own view, is, you know, when we start talking about free speech, then we try to elevate this conversation around what's going on right now to the level of high principle. And the fact of the matter is that free speech is never absolute, right? In American jurisprudence, Supreme Court jurisprudence, if you shout fire in, you know, the famous example, in a crowded theater, that is not protected speech because that is speech that will have certain consequences, right? It incites violence or incites public disorder to a degree that is not protected. Burning a cross on someone's lawn or on your own lawn is not protected speech, right? And we've had famous Supreme Court cases around that. Again, because these are symbols that are associated with certain actions, right? They're not just speech, pure and simple. And so if you see it that way, it's not just free speech as an absolute, you know, principle, but one that is always sort of devolved into questions around, well, what are the implications of this speech, right? Does it incite violence? Does it have, you know, kind of a history that is contrary to the norms or moral ideals of this country? Then that sort of speech is on shakier ground, right? And so when you're talking about people who are espousing beliefs that date back to lynching, that led to lynching of thousands of Americans, you know, in the in and around the turn of the 20th century, when they led to policies, Jim Crow era policies, when they sort of fueled the fire for eugenics, you know, sort of arguments around the turn of the 20th century, then that to me indicates that, well, there's nothing to be gained by listening to or allowing these people to speak these kinds of ideas because they're not new ideas. We have a very deep history with those ideas. We know what has happened to those ideas. We have ample examples of that, you know, not just in this country, but also Nazi Germany as well. And when we say perhaps that, no, they don't have protected speech, or would we deny them the right to, you know, give a talk on campus, it is because we already know where that road goes, right? There's nothing to be learned from that. It's not an actual dialogue. It's not something to be debated, right? Or hopefully it's not something to be debated. And in that sense, then, I'm less sympathetic to, you know, arguments about the free speech rights of some of these individuals. And so when you see counter-protesters who are willing to, you know, confront, you know, say the Unite the Right rally or other speakers who espouse these ideas, then, you know, I'm sympathetic to that because they are individuals, members of the community who are saying, no, this is not something that we want to tolerate because we already know where that goes, right? And it is sort of, there's a kind of false equivalence that equates their free speech rights with you know, say the rights of other members of the community or marginalized members of the community to speak.
What's your reaction to the events in Charlottesville? Have you witnessed an act of racism or discrimination in your community? Weigh in on KCPW's Facebook page, KCPW88.3, or feel free to email us at comments@kcpw.org with your feedback and questions. Thanks to the KCPW team for their support of this show, and thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this program on our website, kcpw.org. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Means. Thanks for listening.